This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Richard Powers, won the National Book Award for Fiction last month for his novel, The Echo Maker. Before he started writing books, he studied science, and his knowledge of science, medicine, and computers is apparent in his novels like The Goldbug Variations, Operation Wandering Soul, and Galatea 2.2. The Echo Maker is about the mysteries of consciousness and identity and draws on the discoveries of neuroscience. As the book opens, a 27-year-old man is lying in a coma after surviving a car accident, and his sister is on her way to see him in the hospital. She watches over him as he emerges from the coma and slowly seems to become more like his old self. But something has gone wrong in his brain. He thinks his sister is really an imposter. Richard Powers, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on the National Book Award. I'd like you to start with a reading from your new book, The Echo Maker. Would you just set it up for us?
In this passage, Karen Schluter, who has returned to the hometown that she spent her life trying to escape, is nursing her brother back from a very severe car accident. And he has come back a great part of the way from a full coma. But as she discovers in this passage and continues to discover, he's not coming back quite as the brother that he was before the accident. So this passage is focalized through Karen. He talked more than he had before the accident. He swung from bouts of rage into a sweetness he'd lost at the age of 8. She told him the doctors wanted to move him out of the hospital. Mark glowed. He thought he was going home. Can you tell my sister I've got the green light? Tell her Mark Schluter is out of here. Whatever's been holding her up, she'll know where to find me. She bit her lip and refused even to nod. She'd read in one of Daniel's neurology books never to humor delusions. She'll be worried about me. Man, you have to promise me. Wherever she's gone, she needs to know what's happening. She was, like, always looking after me. That's her big thing. Personal claim to fame. Saved my life once. My father came this close to snapping my neck like a pencil. I'll tell you about it someday. Personal stuff. But trust me, I'd be dead without my sister. It tore her up to look on and say nothing. And yet, she felt a sick fascination at the chance to learn what Mark really said about her when talking to someone else. She could survive this, for however long it took him to come back to reason. And his reason was solidifying daily. Maybe they're keeping her away from me. Why won't they let me talk to her? Am I somebody's science project? They want to see if I'll mistake you for her? He saw her distress, but mistook it for indignation. Hey, okay, you've helped me too in your own way. You're here every day, walking, reading, whatever. I don't know what you want, but I'm the grateful recipe. Recipient, she said. He stared at her, baffled. You said recipe. You mean recipient? He scowled. I was using the singular. You look a lot like her, you know. Maybe not quite as pretty, but damn close.
That's Richard Powers reading an excerpt of his novel, The Echo Maker. Richard, tell us a little bit about the neurological disorder that's responsible for the character, you know, for the brother not being able to recognize his sister and thinking that she's impersonating his sister.
The disorder is called Capgras syndrome. It's one of a family of misidentification syndromes. And in Capgras, the sufferer looks upon people close to him as somehow substitutions. And the disorder is remarkable because it's very selective. The sufferer has no problems with neighbors or colleagues or even friends. But those people who he's most intimate with emotionally, those people he loves, he refuses to accept. He says they look like my family, they sound like my family, they act like my family, but they're imposters. They've been substituted. They're government agents or they're aliens.
Is there any neurological explanation for why this syndrome only affects people who you're very close to?
The prevailing suggestion is that when we make a recognition, there are at least three regions of the brain that are involved, and one does the actual pattern matching, color of hair, width of eyes, length of face, and this is extremely precise. We have very specialized circuits in place for recognizing faces. Of course, there's the portion of the brain that's responsible for memory association. So once you make a face recognition, there's a whole slew of memory traces and associations that are released by that face. And in a Capgras sufferer, both of those are intact, and they're both still speaking to each other, both of those regions. What's missing is what the rest of us still have, namely a very low-level area of the brain called the amygdala, which is responsible for deep-seated emotions, you know, very primal hope and fear. In the Capgras sufferer, this simply isn't somehow in triggered or in communication with these other two areas when a facial recognition is made. So in a sense, the sufferer looks at someone and says, this looks like my sister, dresses like my sister, sounds like my sister, acts like my sister. It just doesn't feel like my sister.
You know, in reading your book and in reading about this rare neurological disorder in which you believe that your loved ones are really imposters, it made me think about movies like Invasion of the Body Snatchers and Invaders from Mars. Now, in those movies, the people really are imposters. They're science.
Right,
they're science fiction films with like elaborate metaphors within them. But I was wondering if you were thinking about that too. How this seems to be an almost like archetypical fear.
In fact, the neurologists and neuroscientists who write about Capgras often mention those kinds of narratives, those films. And I guess it is a deep-seated fear. And I think it's because even those of us who haven't experienced full-fledged Capgras, either in as a sufferer or as a witness to one, must somehow sense that that capacity, that decoupling of intellectual recognition and emotional recognition, is in us. And in fact, Capgras may just be an extreme case of the kinds of things that any one of us could experience in a temporary or attenuated way. I mean, the most obvious example is, you know, who of us hasn't sworn undying love for someone and incredibly intimate and profound self-shaking connection to a loved one, and then after some passage of time and change in events say, no, actually, I was wrong. I don't feel connected to that person at all. And we're all completely capable of re-narrating ourselves.
No. And what you say in that situation is, you're not the person I once knew. You're not the person I fell in love with. You're not
something
my real
happened.
Mother. Yeah, or whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
Something happened to you.
Something happened to you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And we change our story. You know, it's the self is an incredibly ingenious novelist and is constantly revising its sense of continuity and wholeness.
What you just said about the self being a novelist, I imagine this is one of the reasons why, as a novelist, you're interested in exploring this neurological disorder, because it changes the sense of self and your idea of the people around you. And of course, as a novelist, you're creating selves, lots of them.
That's right. That's right. It was almost inevitable, I think, that I would want to write about these disorders and the deep neurology of narrative at some point. This book is, in some ways, I conceived of it as a neurological mystery story, which in some ways might almost be a redundancy, right? That the brain itself is a kind of mystery story. But the link, of course, is that the processes in the brain are held together by narrative. We report to ourselves, you know, when we think about our identity, who we are, we present ourselves to ourselves as continuous and stable and whole and you know, the same person we were 10 years ago, and completely understandable in a kind of Aristotelian, you know, sense of wholeness, and you know, that our lives have a comprehensible beginning, middle, and end, and it's all very clean. And in fact, the self is just a kind of late day addition to this incredibly noisy parliament of hundreds of parts in the brain, and it's only by very fancy footwork and an insistence on narrative logic that we can hold together these, you know, two or 300 parts and present it to the world as a solid and a single thing.
Now, there's a neurologist in your book who investigates this case and examines the character of Mark. And this is a doctor who seems to be inspired by Dr. Oliver Sacks, the famous neurologist who has written many books of case studies, the case studies of his own patients. It sounds like you want to interrupt me here.
Well, I was just going to say, for purposes of legal protection, I should probably say...
I knew you were going to say that, right.
that Dr. Weber's work in the book probably very closely resembles the kind of work that Sacks does. But as a human being, of course, he draws nothing on the life of Sacks. In fact, the work of the neurologist Gerald Weber in the book is a real composite of 10 or 11 different neurologists, all of whom have done amazing and incredibly fascinating work in documenting neuropsychology over the last 20 or 30 years, all the ways that the brain can go wrong. And, of course, for somebody who's devoted his life to really looking under the hood and seeing what can happen down there noisy kind of seething network of parts, the self can become very unstable just by virtue of the intellectual knowledge of how unreliable the self is.
Yeah, he says, I like this phrase a lot. You have him say that this case is a chance to see just how treacherous the logic of consciousness was.
Yeah, the old unreliable first-person narrator again. What happens, I guess, in the story is that because Mark has been so radically transformed, but can't see that it's he that's different and not the world. His sister has to come and take care of him and be near him and attempt to fulfill her sense of self, which is as the good sister to the bad brother. But the problem for Karen, of course, is that her sense of self depends upon being ratified by her brother in this role that she's given herself, the protector, the caretaker. So when Mark comes out of his disastrous close-head trauma and says, you're not my sister, Karen has to ask herself the question, well, then who am I? She calls the neurologist, Dr. Weber, and interests him in this rare and strange case. She catches him at a moment in his life where his own self-narration, that of an empathetic and a careful examiner of people who haven't been given voice and a kind of presenter of these people to the broader public, has come under fire. The public, in a way, who has embraced his earlier books, has now turned on him and is saying, this isn't empathy, this is exploitation. And he suddenly is challenged to make a more profound empathetic connection to his patients just to prove that his own sense of self is intact.
Now, you studied the sciences before you started writing fiction. What got you to switch from science to literature?
That's a good question. I guess it was a kind of intellectual claustrophobia. You know, when I was young, I was always certain that I would be a scientist, but I couldn't decide which science. You know, one week it was geology, and the next week it was oceanography, and the week after that it was chemistry. And I also, I really loved music, and I loved history and so forth. So when it really came time to specialize and do what we all have to do, namely close all the doors but one, I really panicked. I started school, university as a physics major, with the idea that somehow physics as a kind of fundamental discipline would give me that aerial view where I could somehow connect all these other interests and keep them alive through my own specialized study. And in fact, that wasn't the case. The farther along I went in physics, the more I realized that advancement in the field would really require specialization to the point where I might not even understand the physics that my the next office down was doing in the same department. So I think it was at that point that that I located, I guess recovered in a sense, old love of reading, and thought that perhaps literature as this sort of universal conversation about who we are and how we know the world might be the place to keep that generalist spirit alive. A novel can treat physics, it can treat chemistry, and it can treat history. And in fact, my 9 novels have been forays into all of those other disciplines that at one moment or another in my life I thought I might pursue. So it's an incredibly lucky choice for me. I feel, I wake up every day thinking, how am I getting away with this? I'm actually able to do all these road not takens and live at least for 2 or 3 or 4 years vicariously lives that I had to close the door to long ago.
Now, I've read that you've been using computers since the 1970s, since like the mid-70s, is that about right? Earlier than
That's
that?
Right. Okay. Maybe a little earlier. I got my first personal computer in 77. So that was about the time when they were really first appearing as commercially available products.
And you've written computer-related themes in your fiction. But on the other hand, like this new book, apparently instead of sitting at a computer and typing the words onto the page, you used voice recognition software so you could speak the words onto
that's right.
into the computer. And I found that kind of interesting. I don't know, speaking for myself, not that I'm a writer, but I do have to write things, but I find like it almost uses a different part of my brain to write than to speak. And I'm not sure that that's a bad thing, because there's a certain carefulness you want in your writing that is impossible to get in your speaking. You feel like if somebody's reading you, that you owe them, you know what I mean? You owe them a more careful and considered and perfected language. That is, I think, probably easier to get in a writing kind of mode. And I really wanted to hear your thoughts about that.
Yeah. Well, you've put your finger on it. Typing and speaking are two completely different neurological activities. Both are very complicated. Both are going to invoke, each one is going to invoke very different combinations of regions of the brain. And we put tremendous amount of effort into learning how to type and learning how to compose and type at the same time. It's, however, a highly artificial interface and extremely unnatural. You know, it's a little bit like a dog walking on its hind legs. And there are many things that you can't do when composing and typing at the same time. If you've ever tried to talk to somebody who's typing, you can see just how fully engaging the act of pressing out one letter at a time on a keyboard is. For me, the great advantage of speaking over typing is it puts me in touch with longer phrases. It allows me to think in terms of the music of the prose. I'm not constantly interrupting my memory to change from inventing a clause and then keying it in letter by letter, which is the exact opposite of sense and sound. Rather, I can hear my character speak. I can hear the rhythm and the meaning of the passage that I'm working on. I can flow more smoothly directly from memory to composition. And, of course, I can always go back and edit and do the kind of careful massaging that you're talking about. The first spoken draft is just the beginning. But here's an example. When you write, if you're like a lot of writers, you will read that passage aloud at some point, either to yourself or to someone else. Flaubert, for instance, is great about, he had this this place that he would go to and he would yell out his sentences as a way of testing their authenticity and testing their music. And that's because when we read, we subvocalize and we hear sentences and paragraphs as oral phenomena. And much of the meaning of a passage comes about through the sound. So for me, being able to hear the sound during composing puts me in greater proximity to the way that this sentence is going to mean in the mind of the reader.
Okay, so you spoke your book with voice recognition software into your computer. At the same time, I understand that you didn't speak for a year when you were younger.
Yeah. Well,
when was that and why?
That was actually in 1998. I was living way out on the North Shore of Long Island. And it was partly self-imposed. I wanted to put myself into a new state of consciousness for writing a very different kind of book. It was the book Plowing the Dark, which involved, in part, the experience of a hostage in Beirut in the late 80s. And I guess the idea in part was to again, do a kind of vicarious, empathetic, to the extent possible, recreation of the consciousness of what happens to us when we're that isolated and we don't have this network of people to see and connect to and ratify ourselves against. I think also it's just as an experiment as a writer to see what would happen to my prose after that degree of isolation. It was a way of refreshing, I think, and reinventing myself as a writer.
So during the period when you weren't speaking, like when you were out in the street and like people weren't close enough to you, you know, didn't know you well enough to know that you had decided not to speak for a certain amount of time, what did you do when people would ask you something? I mean, you weren't carrying a sign saying, "Sorry, guys, I'm mute this year."
No, that's right.
I mean, I couldn't. Yeah,
I couldn't do. You know, I couldn't actually do the experiment as completely as I would have wanted.
Oh, I see.
You know, I still had to go shopping. You know, and I still had to buy my groceries. And when the cashier said,
right,
"How are you doing?" You know, I mean, at that point, you know, what was really interesting, you know, how are you doing? And there I would be stuttering and stammering, you know, to try to remember how I was doing. Those minor interruptions actually, and the amount of limited social contact that I did have during that time period was always intensified because of that background of silence and the awareness that after this interaction I'd be going back into the cave.
You know, in your novel, you're using this neurological disorder to help you explore the question, what gives us our sense of self? And what are some of the ways that can go wrong? When you were 11, your family moved to Bangkok, Thailand, because your father became the principal of the International School of Bangkok. How did it change your sense of self when, as an 11-year-old, when your sense of self is still being formed, you were suddenly in a country in a very different part of the world?
Yeah, I think on that, and I think that really was the transforming event in my life. At 11, you know, the brain is so plastic still. You know, before puberty, we moved to Bangkok, and within 6 months, I was speaking Thai, just from being out on the street, you know, not without any formal study. You know, when you have a new immersive experience when you're young, you're completely capable, you know, chameleon-like, of just changing and taking on this alter ego. The real culture shock for me happened when I came back to the United States at 16. You know, I thought I knew this place, and I thought it was my country and my culture. And in fact, those years away, being in another country, you know, speaking another language and living a very different kind of life, made it a weirdly estranging experience. You know, they talk about misidentification syndromes. You know, here I was back in the Midwest, back in suburban Chicago, and simultaneously recognizing my native country and feeling very much estranged and outside it. And I think that's the kind of prototype experience that creates the narrative imagination when you're both in your life and sitting on your own shoulder looking at it as if you were an outsider. That kind of double existence, I think, really was instrumental in me in setting up a kind of sensibility that was invaluable later on in telling stories.
You know, that sense that you were describing of, like, living life, but also kind of sitting on your shoulder watching yourself live your life.
Mm. Yeah.
It's kind of like the writer's position in some ways, because you're doing it and then you're standing back and observing and reporting to yourself on what it is.
Absolutely the writer's position.
Yeah, so okay, it's the writer's position, but it's not a very comfortable position when you're not writing, I don't think. I mean, how do you like that feeling of standing outside yourself and watching yourself?
Well, you know, it's interesting because in a way, that's the condition that I try to create in Dr. Weber in the book. He simultaneously...
This is the neurologist.
That's right, the neurologist who's been called in to study Mark. His wife, for instance, teases him. He has become well known as a popularizer of neuropsychology, and she refers to the role that he plays in public as Famous Gerald. And so Weber is simultaneously doing his science and doing his writing, but aware of the degree to which he is performing this other person. So again, it was for me, it was a pleasure to kind of vicariously inhabit somebody who suffers from the writer's ailment, never entirely both feet inside the experience, but recursively aware of the degree to which they are performing themselves. And you're absolutely right. When you can't do that, when you can't somehow move back and forth from the world of experience to the world of imagination and the world of representation, a sense of vertigo and disorientation does result, which is why I think you scratch a writer and you're going to find a compulsive inventor, and someone who if he or she isn't writing for a couple of days, is bound to descend pretty quickly into erratic behavior.
Well, Richard Powers, thanks so much for talking with us, and again, congratulations on the National Book Award.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Richard Powers' latest novel, The Echo Maker, won the National Book Award for Fiction last month.